living, grabbing and seize the moment. My time is now, my flow is rolling, my name was chosen by a couple that grew up to this day. They taught me everything I know, that's why I'm built this way. To put my face in a position, take flight with grace. I learned from living and making mistakes, forsaking my place, to face and relate. Whatever the stakes, it's our match, you cop it 10 bucks. It's more than a case, it's more than it takes. Of my soul and of my life and of my past. Focus on the future to make time last, to make you all want it, and make the world want it. It's like crack, cause you can't sleep on it.
Now I'm in the limelight cause I rhyme tight. Time to get paid, blow up like the World Trade.
Well, thank you. This is Andrew Fetter with When Pigs Fly, and you're just listening to Since Birth by Samson. He's a local hip-hop artist here in town. You can check his thing out on any of the Amazon, Tower Records, or any other place. Again, that was Since Birth. Man, that's pretty rad. Well, I have a change of plans. By the way, I'm coming from live from Las Vegas, Nevada, and here it's gotten a little bit hot. Right now, it's only 97. Wait till it hits up to 106 in about another hour. And I had a change of plans. I was going to have an interview this week, and things had changed. I guess everything has its reasons for doing changing. That's what I truly believe, that everything is meant to be. I mean, we do have a course of action, but there are certain events that we do create and happen. We facilitate and manipulate with our own minds by our own manifestations, which I will get into, which are the thoughts or things. We have the ability to create, even on voluntary, which I think is more voluntary level. But I will get into that later in the bottom part of the show. And the reason why is because I want to get into a very issue that I'm very passionate about. Well, one of the issues I'm very passionate about, having lived there and seen firsthand of events, and I'm talking about within the Middle East, with particularly within Israel, and particularly with what the Palestinians, Arabs, and so on. And the reason why is because I want to cut the crap. I hear a lot of pure bullshit, and it just finally got, that's it. Enough is enough. I can't hear anymore, People try to be politically correct, nonchalant, when they do not know what the hell is going on over there. And they see things on TV, they read things even on the internet, but they're not there, and they don't have enough effing clue what it is over there, period. Now, let me give you another thing I need to really get into so you know the situation, first of all, about Israel and what it is. Because this is another thing that people who are not Jewish, and even a lot of Jews, don't ever really get. And they never will get it. It's like, it's like telling a black person their oppression and their situation, and then the prejudice and the hate from non-blacks, white people hatred toward blacks. And you don't know it until you walk into their shoes and you actually see prejudice and racial situations. This is a Jew. You would, unless you're inside the embodiment of a Jew, and even then so, some even don't even recognize it themselves, but they will not understand the anti-Semitism and the the true vehement hatred of people who project that or who are walking down that path of darkness. And I don't judge them as individuals, by the way. because I don't judge people ever. There's a big difference of judging an action and judging a person. I do judge an action. Everybody has the right to and has their feeling and looking away. Somebody judge an action. Just as you would judge an action of somebody killing or murdering or raping somebody, you can judge that action. This is why you can judge an action where somebody provides charity and goodwill and mercy and help and love and yada-da. On the other hand, so now let me tell you about my background. And by the way, if any of you don't know, I had, and you can always check my website, www.andrewfetter.com. It has a brief, background on myself. I did live in Israel, by the way, for 6 years. Prior to that, actually, I was an exchange student. I lived there in 77 through 78. In fact, it's sort of interesting. Now, the first time I went to visit Jerusalem, the same day I went to go to Jerusalem, the first time I ever went there was the same day Anwar Sadat came to Jerusalem. In fact, I had the newspaper and everything. I don't know what the hell I did with it, but I have it somewhere. I kept it. But during the 80s, when I moved there, at the time with my ex-wife, I lived on a farm in a moshav, grew grapes and whatnot. And one of my closest friends who I developed, in fact, it was sort of funny because we didn't have such a liking, but he became my best friend, and vice versa. He was my brother in Israel, and he was an Arab. Actually lives in Kfar Kara. And I know every time I go there or visit, or if he even came here, you know, our hands are extended. So I have an in-depth understanding of culture within the Arab community. I used to visit their village, and he actually is an Israeli Arab, but I used to go a lot of times, I mean a lot, to the northern villages in the West Bank, which is sort of funny. They call, like, for example, Jenin or Tukaram a refugee camp, and believe me, they're not. It's a city. It's not a refugee camp. Maybe in Lebanon, those are refugee camps, but there are no real refugee camps in the West Bank. Okay, and that's another thing. And then there's the situation in Gaza, which I'll get into. By the way, Gaza's always had. It's been totally filled with millions of people living there. It's always been overcrowded, and it's a different situation than the Arabs or the Palestinians that live in the West Bank during the 80s, now I'm telling you. And people have this idea, because they see the situation now, that they're definitely under financial burdenship and stuff like that. And by the way, that is out of the proxy of choice, which I did talk about in prior shows. But I'll get into that. But I want people to understand where they were back in the 80s. And why events evolved where they were. Because people have no effing clue what is real. What is the situation. And it bothers me because they don't. Okay, first of all, I'll give you them. Tukaram, I know, let me put it this way. The West Bank Arabs, most of them, the Palestinians in those areas, in the 80s, were living wealthier than the average American. They had more money than the average American. I'm telling you this. I know for a fact. Because I know the cash they had on hand. And I don't want to get into why I know, but I do know. They used to stick thousands and thousands of dollars in underneath their floor tiles because they had nowhere to put it. That was like their bank. They used to buy Mercedes and BMWs in cash. They'd build their homes in cash, multi-levels. During the 80s, the Arabs in the West Bank lived almost extremely well. And there's two reasons for that. One, they weren't privy to taxes like the Israelis, or Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs and Israeli Christians, and just Israelis, period. In proper Israel. They were subjugated to those taxes. And yet they were also, they had a Jordanian citizenship, by the way. And then, by the way, since 1970, since Israel came to the defense of Jordan and help save them through during the Civil War against Arafat and the PLO, who had tried to overthrow their government. And also, that's why they ended up going to Lebanon, were in a de facto peace. In fact, they were great trading. I remember sending produce when I first got there. In fact, the beginning, when I first lived in Israel, I lived in just for a short period, about 3-4 months, I lived on a settlement near Jericho, or Jericho, and we sent produce across the border all the time. And we'd stamp without a stamp. The stamp would say to Saudi Arabia and to both in Arabic and English. And where they put the normal stamp would just be made in Israel, because you weren't supposed to have that on there, because they weren't to acknowledge that they were really getting it. They didn't want other Arab countries to know that they were really getting their products from Israel. But there was great trade, by the way, going to Jordan. Jordan was acting the middleman, going to Saudi Arabia and a lot of the, even Kuwait and all the Arab Emirates. I mean, you know, it's a fact that even Dubai has a real great industrial relationship with Israel. It's so funny. They don't want to talk about it. It's all economics, you know. I mean, Zim, their trading is tight with a lot of the Dubai shipping companies. So what I'm gathering at, I'm trying to explain, is it's not what you really see. It's what's really under what's happening. And I was trying to explain to you where they were, the Arabs, the Palestinians, in the West Bank for particular, where they were. Because it's really important we could know how they evolve, how the situation evolved where it is. Because, again, enough of the BS. People have no damn clue of what's the situation. So they evolved. You know, I mean, they were making money. They were living quite wealthy. I'm saying the average. I'm talking average. I'm talking laborers, even. People had, I know they'd set up, like, labor groups. A lot of the Arabs in the West Bank, they'd actually wouldn't go individually and go, hey, you know, can I work at $5.95 an hour? No, what they used to do, they're really smart. In fact, by the way, they're one of the smartest groups of Arabs within the of the Palestinians, are probably the most highly educated, and I'm just telling you, well in depth, I'm just telling you. And anyway, they would form like groups, and they're called labor groups, and that's how they would do labor, almost like a labor company for Israelis. And that's how they would make their money. And they also became like a, like I said, they were great merchants. They were the in-between. Because where they take the produce, and since Israelis could not go across the border with their produce into Jordan, they're the ones who did it. So they were like almost like the shipping agent, the middleman. And it would go the other way, too. I mean, stuff that came in from Arab countries into Jordan or countries, whatever. I mean, in Israelis, I remember buying lumber and stuff, and products and stuff, inside Tukaram and Jenin, and like I said. So there, it's not exactly how people think it was. And now I said to you, they were Jordanian citizens. They were living well under Israeli occupation. By the way, that's another thing that really gets to me when people talk about occupation. And if any American says a word about occupation, about Israeli occupation, they need to get their little white ass back to Europe, because wherever they're living on their occupiers. Every single American living here on this land are occupiers, except for the Native Americans. And that includes all the Mexicans. That includes all the Asians. We are all occupiers. Now, this wasn't part of Mexico. It was Mojave. It was Apache, Comanche, Paiute, Shoshone. It wasn't La Raza. And the same thing in New York, part of the Iroquois Nation, whether it was, you know, Mohican or Huron. They're all occupiers, so it's sort of, you're like talking with your foot in your mouth if you call Israel being occupiers. In fact, if you go around the world, every country, every peoples have occupied other people's lands, including even Britain. I mean, why they call them Anglo-Saxons? Where are the Saxons from? They are from the Vikings. You know, they're from Vikings. You know, the area that they're Norwegian from. You know, they're not from there. The true Britons were, you know, very few Britons. That's why they call them Anglo-Saxons. So anyway, I don't want to get every... So people's moved around. You know, so you can't say what are occupiers. I mean, and nobody ever talks about Tibet being occupied by China, which is illegally occupied. And it wasn't like the situation that happened in Israel, by the way, was out of defense, not offense. Once they end up taking control of the West Bank, and people say, oh, well, they did a preemptive attack against Egypt, but they forget. And, you know, and it's funny because I looked on blogs and stuff, and I'm known jumping here now. But Al Jazeera, I mean, when they're talking about in BBS, they conveniently leave out that what initiated the Israelis to finally put the initiated the attack was actually out of an act of war by Egypt. Not only did they had built up their forces and, you know, the rhetoric about wiping off Israel off the face of the planet, but they had actually blocked, did a naval blockade in the Straits of Tehran. And with the Straits of Tehran, it's the area waterways that were a lot, the southern port for Israel is, and they literally blocked it. With a naval blockade. That's an act of war. That's like if we took a bunch of ships and circled around L.A. or New York and said, you know, not one ship's coming out. There'd be a war. I mean, that's how what started, like, for example, the War of 1812. So that was an act of war. And Israel, of course, defended itself. And then when they attacked Egypt, Jordan attacked Israel, Syria attacked Israel, Israel defended itself, got the and won, and frankly, la la la. That's how come they have the West Bank. Now let me get the issue of where what happened. Now, like I said, in the West Bank, the Arabs living there were Jordanian citizens. Now in Gaza, they were never Egyptian citizens. That was the other issue that helped cause the biggest problem. Most people, including our country and most countries, when a person, you know, immigrates, they have a path of bringing them into their citizenship. So they bring them in, you know, become a citizen. And Egypt never did it, and Jordan was the only country that did it because they had annexed the area that they felt it wasn't part of Palestine. They felt that was part of Jordan. So they were Jordanian citizens, you know, and then Syria never did it. And another thing I never brought up is I want to bring up or two is back then nobody ever talks about I think it was close to 700,000, almost a million Jews who were kicked out of Israel by all the Arab countries after Israel became a nation. And they were basically refugees. And then they're streamlined back into Israel and other, and also in the U.S. for their freedom. I mean, they came from Morocco to Tunisia to Libya to Egypt to Syria, Iraq, Yemen. All those Jews were kicked out of their own country, their properties taken away, just like Nazi Germany. So anyway, let me get back to now the West Bank because before I jump into that. Now, they did live pretty well, like I said. And then what happened was, in 1988, toward the end of the 80s, and like I said, Jordan and Israel were in very, very good relations. Israel, Jordan decided to withdraw its claim to the West Bank because the Israelis implied, and this is where the Israeli source pretty much screwed up, implied that they were going to annex the West Bank. Just like they had annexed when they took over Jerusalem and then Golan Heights. But they were seriously going to annex the area. And most of the Arabs outside of the, or Palestinians or Arabs, whatever, in the West Bank, if you would sit there and talk outside the front doors, yeah, oh, I don't like Israel and I'm Palestinian. You close the door, man. They wanted to be Israeli. So bad. Because they knew the benefits. Do you think they would want to be a citizen of some country where they have no rights? Whether it's in Egypt, Jordan, Syria, they don't have the same freedom of speech. the same type of any democracy at all. And the advancements that they would receive, living where they, you know. I mean, think about it. And they really did. I'm just telling you. Under a closed door, every single one wanted to be an Israeli. Every single there. I even had a friend of mine who was, he was a communist. And yeah, he was like working at anti-Israel. But when I closed the door, he says, I want to be an Israeli citizen. I was like laughing. It was sort of funny. And by the way, where I was coming from at the time when I was living in Israel, I was very religious. The moshav I lived in was part of the movement that was part of Menachem Begin's party, which was called the Likud, but it was called in the side of the Beitar movement, which is, I would say, more revisionist, more right-wing in the sense that in Israel. But if you took, by the way, their parties, like the Likud, and brought them over here in the U.S., it'd be more left-wing. it's just that they're more to the right compared to, let's say, the Maroth, which is the Labor Party movements, which is sort of funny. But anyway, in the 80s, when they decided to, with the Jordanians, withdraw their claim, and Israel was intending to annex there, Israelis just began realizing, we can't do that. It's going to change the demographics of the country. There's eventually, that's because they'll be bringing a huge Arab population within amongst Jews, and they're trying to maintain, and this sounds may sound racist, but it really isn't. They're just trying to maintain their own, have their own national, their own country, basically. And they do, by the way, anybody can come to Israel and live in Israel. It doesn't matter Jew or Christian or whatever, or, you know, it's, you can become a citizen through their, you know, just like coming to the United States, you go through your, you know, immigrated situation, you come there and then live there for so many years. The only thing they do have is called a right of return. That's for a Jew only. That only makes the difference is their time for becoming a citizen is quicker. Nothing, that's the only difference. But they both become citizens. And when I lived there, by the way, I chose not to become a citizen right away, and that's over some personal situations. I chose to just remain a permanent resident. But getting back to the West Bank, it did cause them to reflect, oh my God, what are we going to do here? Now, what they should have done is just do joint control, which is called the loan plan, which they were talking about. Joint control, well, so much joint control, because they were going to actually divide up the land and return part of it back to Jordan and part to Israel, but they never followed through with it. And then there was talk of even doing joint control, which is actually, I think, it would have been the best. But what they instead did is, because the Jordanians withdrew their citizenship from the Arabs in the West Bank, caused a vacuum. They were no longer able just to cross the border into Jordan no more, because they were no longer citizens. It was like taking your license. All these people had their businesses and license, and it says, okay, you're no longer import-export business. They restricted them. And then they had non-citizens. They weren't part of Israel. They weren't part of Jordan. And, of course, then a select few extremists took advantage and started what they call the Infidia, which is the uprising. And hell, they were upset. I would be upset too, because I don't know where I'm going to be. Naturally, there was the wanting to have their own autonomy, their own state, their own situation. Being Palestinian, they want now Palestine, have a Palestinian entity. So what happened is Shimon Peres, after the Madrid conference, reached out, by the way, the Palestinians weren't even represented. The Israelis reached out across and met with Arafat and the PLO to enter into some sort of situation, which later became the Oslo Agreement, which was a foundation to bring about a Palestinian state. And because of that, the EU, the European Union, and the U.S., gave billions of dollars to develop a country. Because if they develop, if the Palestinians then continue now built their own infrastructure, as far as economy, factories, roads, schools, you know, and had and use that money to back up all new business, Palestinian business, so they were sort of basically independent of Israel and Jordan to supply them with, you know, some sort of economy, it would change. And the same thing in Gaza. And they, in the beginning, they built some, you know, they even put, built the Americans and the Europeans built airports and schools. But a lot of the money that went into the PLO was diverted. It was stolen basically by Arafat and a lot of his cohorts. In fact, just on a note, Arafat was never Palestinian. He was born and raised in Egypt, in Cairo. He went to Cairo University. He was in the Cairo military. He lived briefly with his uncle who lived in Jerusalem. He was never really Palestinian, but that's a whole other thing. And he diverted all those the monies, and when he died, he was one of the top richest people in the world. Top 10. He had billions. In fact, he had so much money, that's why he was able to basically buy, he can buy people to stand and cheer for him, buy people to smile for him. I mean, you can imagine, he was one of the top 10 richest people in the world. His wife didn't even live in the West Bank or Gaza. And his daughter, they lived in Paris. Shows the nationalism and what his idea of coming back to being a Palestinian. But all the monies were diverted. And then the same token, what he did do, and they got down. That's why he never really wanted to go down. And, you know, in 2000, they almost got with Clinton, when they almost got to the situation of signing the agreement in the late 90s, where Israel was basically going to give the West Bank, Gaza, and even give part of Jerusalem, and they would have had a Palestinian state right then and there with Barak and all that. He rejected it. And why? Because he wanted the game to continue, the still game. So they instigated hate. To keep the, it's the, you know, old hate game and violent game. That's, he instilled it. And that's when the terrorism and all that stuff started happening. While that was going in Israel and everybody was focused on that, he was letting the money keep on getting stolen. And that's why you hear about the corruption of the Fatah and all that, and suppose that's why the Hamas was chosen, which is partially maybe right, but, you know, I'm sorry, but there's more to it than that. Which is what I was going to get into. There's a deep hatred toward Jews. And to amongst the Muslims, and not just the Muslim hating Jews, they also don't care too much for Christians as well. And on this, I'm being general, but if you have an average Arab on the street, they're actually taught this. I'm telling you, they're taught this in the mosque. I mean, when they get to know you, they go, wait, I didn't know Jews like this. Because they're taught constantly to hate. It's like a white person constantly instilled to hate a black person, or a black person instilled to hate a white person. In fact, if any of you want, I have a tape, it's not a tape, it's actually on YouTube. If you like, you can email me, and I'll email back to you the link on YouTube. A great tape that was an interview by actually an Arab journalist who was running around, I guess, like into several Arab, you know, the Muslim countries, and he's interviewing. The first part is about Barak and about being anti-Jewish, and he was making a joke. And then here's the real part, and that's where it gets into showing. The second part is dealing with the anti-Semitism, and this Arab journalist goes around shaking, you know, talking to Muslims, and in Arabic ask them, you know, would you shake a hand with a Jew, and da da da, and oh God, yeah, you know, and. You know, and they start talking about, oh, they hate the Jews, and they should be wiped off the planet, and we should kill them all. I mean, it was almost like listening to Nazi Germany in the 1930s. And any of you want to, my link, I'll send it to you. It's my, by the way, my email address is on the site on BBS Radio, but I'll give it to you here. It's flyingpigs, at artlover.com. Again, it's Flying Pigs, Pigs Like Flying, at art, A-R-T, lover.com. I'd be happy to re-email you or forward you the link on YouTube. And also dealing with a situation of hate, there's another person love to you should listen to. You can either Google her or do a search on YouTube. Her name is Brigitte Gabrielle. She was a Lebanese Christian who lived in southern Lebanon. And you can listen to her how the genocide of Christians who had lived in southern Lebanon, how they're basically wiped, literally ethnically cleansed, pure and simple to put it. I mean, by the way, Lebanon was 90% Christian. During the 80s when I was there, and I don't want to get into the Lebanese war, what my situation was there, because that's a whole other story. But southern Lebanon, most of it was Maronite Christian. And in fact, it was weird watching on TV during last year's war and seeing all the villages that were once mainly Maronites are now under Shiite or Hezbollah control, which is really pretty bizarre. But getting back to the Palestinian situation again, I'm getting off tangent, and I do want to get into thoughts or things. It created a problem with the Enfidia, and that's where they started. There was a rise, a choice, and then the Israelis, of course, like I said, went into the Oslo Agreement, and all of a sudden, money's endured, and violence started. So there was choice. Things were being chosen, because, by the way, a lot of the Palestinians weren't even doing anything. In fact, they were being taught to hate in their schools, taught to hate Jews. You don't have that, and I'm safe to tell you, you don't have that in Israeli schools. You don't have where the government is sponsoring hate toward Muslims. Yeah, there is racism, and people, you know, don't like, you know, whatever, or whatever you want. There's a minute, whatever. But it's not like sponsored. It's not being taught. It's not being integrated. It's not integrated. You don't go to a synagogue or a church and they're told to hate that religion or that person. But they're actually taught this in the mosque. I heard it. I was like so shocked when I heard it. And then when I started talking to them, they allowed me into their mosque. And then they said to me, the reason why you're allowed to go in the mosque, oh, you're a Jew. And they, by the way, they call it Israelis. They call them Yehud. Yehud is Jew in Arabic. That's what they call Israelis, Yehud. So when they talk about Israeli or Yehud, they're talking all Jews around the world. That's how they refer to you. So there was a vehement hatred being developed. And it's a tool, the old tool, to subjugate the people, to get them, you know, not realizing their own rights. And if they had sense of self-worth, they wouldn't hate. They'd follow the path of light and love, which should be emphasized within organized religions, but a lot of times aren't. But right at this present, there isn't that in, I hate to say it, in modern Islam, which people do not, in today's Islam being taught in most mosques. You don't hear imams standing up and saying enough is enough. You do have, though, I'm proud to say that in Turkey, they stood up to the Islamic fascism that was trying to be perpetrated on their country, that they want to be have a separate, and it, you know, there's, hey, you want to go to church, you want to go to mosque, you want to go to temple, that's fine, but not in our government. That was pretty interesting to see that in Turkey. But anyway, getting back to the choice of the Palestinians, they made choices. They didn't choose to have an opportunity in the state, and that was, sorry to say, that was due to Arafat, but they did elect him as their leader. They did elect Fatah to run their country. And then when the Israelis withdrew from Gaza, and after Arafat was no longer, he had passed away, and Abu Mazen, President Assad, he was the Palestinians, had now had an opportunity to make peace, finally get the thing settled with Israel and go back to the plan they were offered back in the late 90s and work some situation out where they could conveniently move. But he had the problem where he did not have control of Hamas or Islamic Jihad. And he was afraid to, for obvious reasons. He was afraid to get into what eventually was going to happen anyway. It was a civil war. He was afraid that, you know, them killing, Palestinian killing Palestinian. But it would happen because he was afraid to confront what was there already. He had to deal with that in order to really make peace with Israel. To remove the catalyst that was causing the problems in the first place. The catalyst that caused the problems for the Palestinians. It wasn't the Israelis, but why they put security fences, why they put a wall, why they make it hard for Palestinians to come into the country to work, which, by the way, they should learn that be able to develop their own economics for themselves, not to rely on Israel for economics or any other country to have their own sovereignty, because that's not really a country. Israel does not, the U.S. does not rely on Canada for its sovereignty. I know that we have problems in Mexico. Mexico right now is relying on the U.S., and that's why they have big problems all the time. It's not even really, it's like a joke. But to be a sovereign country, you have to be independent economically. You know, look at the Brazilians did for their own energy. But anyway, getting back to the Palestinians, they made choices. And when Israel withdrew from Gaza, instead of voting in, you know, as bad as the Fatah did with as far as their corruption stuff, re-electing them in their parliament. By the way, Hamas did not win by a majority. They won by 40%. And they have a parliamentary system, so therefore they were able to take over the government. But they did vote the most. They elected them to be in power. It's like voting the Nazi Party. Can you imagine? It'd be like the United States voting in the Nazi Party. Or let's say it was a part Nazi Party that said, we don't like Canadians or we don't like Mexicans. Wouldn't that be something sickening? Yeah, they were elected. But if this country decided we hate Mexico, have voted a party that hates Mexicans, Mexico has every right to say, you know what? We don't want to be your. We don't want to deal with you. You hate us so much. And that's basically why would you want to? You know, yes, they voted them in. Their government. And you can say, okay, well, we don't want to deal with you. That's their choice. We don't have to send you our tax money from our citizens to feed and pay for you. And back, because that's like validating what they stand by. They didn't want to validate hatred and war and terrorism. And people go, oh, well, they need to recognize them. They're elected. No, you can recognize them, but you don't have to deal with them. That was a choice. Not only the choices that occurred with the Palestinians, they are now receiving their reward. For every action, there's a reaction. And not saying the Israelis are any better. They should have, personally, I feel they should have frozen expansion or controlled, because it's hard to freeze, but control the expansion of existing settlements in the West Bank until everything was settled. And they should stop building new settlements. But that doesn't give them a reason to send kids to kill other kids or blow up buses filled with people or nightclubs or whatever. It doesn't give you an excuse to kill. That's pathetic. And I don't care how hardship does not give you an excuse for violence. Because I've been in Jamaica 2 years ago, and you go to Kingston, you want to see hardship? They're living worse than the Gazans. I don't care what anybody says. And you know, they're happy as hell. They learn to go with it, but they try to strive and fix their own problems amongst themselves. And make it better for themselves. They don't go. You don't see Jamaicans strapping on bombs and killing off tourists left and right, or killing people. You know, I mean, they have violence. Yeah, they do in Kingston, for example. But they don't go around and, you know what I'm saying? There's not terrorism. I mean, there's a lot of strife. And look at Darfur. That's strife. That's. Go to Africa. That's bad. And that was sort of, I mean, in a spiritual sense, everybody has choice, but in a political sense, the people in Darfur didn't have a political choice. That was thrown on them. But the people in Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza and the Palestinians in the West Bank, they had choice, and they got whatever reaction there is in action. And because of their choices, West Bank, Palestinians lost their economics, their foundation. Out of their choice, they lost where they were back over 20 years ago. When I lived there, they were prosperous. Now they don't have nothing. That was their choice. And I don't care anybody says that was their choice. I don't, you know, you can feel sorry for the kids, and I feel sorry for them and everything, and I feel bad situations, but there are poor people here, too. There are poor people all around the world who are living bad situations. And a lot of people have situations they're born into that I feel sorry about. That's bad. But there are choices made that create situations. And what's happening right now, by the way, in the Middle East, there's going to eventually be peace. Now, and I'm going to tell you, and you mark my words, there's not going to be a Palestinian state. There never was because, first of all, it wasn't the Israelis who don't want a Palestinian state. Only, by the way. By the way, they were trying to get a Palestinian just to get the thing situated. The Jordanians and Egyptians really don't want a Palestinian state. Especially the Jordanians. In fact, they came out and said, hey, as soon as you're a state, we'll bring you in, be part of Jordan, and you'll be a Confederate state. Because they didn't want, that's what they even said. Abbas even agreed to it. So there was never going to be, they were going to be part of Jordan, basically. And this is what's going to come down. And you're going to see it, because it's all about the Benjamins, all about the economics. It's been going on. Israel entered, and you can see if you're reading through between the lines, the Israelis and the Jordanians entered in an agreement whereby they would build a joint airport in Aqaba, international airport in Jordan. That would both run and used by both Israelis and Jordanians. They're planning to build rail lines and serious transportation lines and businesses and stuff between Israel and the Jordanians. What does that tell you? This is what's going to happen, folks, and you watch. They're getting into a peace agreement, and in the West Bank, for example, it will become a joint control establishment between the Israelis and Jordanians. Jordan is going to turn itself and call it Jordan/Palestine. That's what they're going to call it. That's how King Hussein, because basically Jordan is a Palestinian state. It's part of the mandate. That's why there's like, 80% Palestinians? Because the ruling faction, which is the Hashemites, which are actually from Saudi Arabia, which his father, great, his grandfather, King Abdullah the First, they're actually Arabians, which are Bedouins. They were Bedouins from Bedouin sheikhs. So you have a small minority of Bedouins running Palestinians, basically. So that's what's going to happen, folks. And you're watching what's happening right now in Gaza. They know, watch what happens between the Egyptians and the Israelis, and even Abbas is going to go with the plan. They're going to get rid of Hamas. They've already called it outlaw. He's even ordered disbanding of his little brigade, for the Al-Qaeda brigade, outlawing any Islamic military or terrorism. And you're going to watch how Gaza ends up being part of Egypt. And then those who are living in the Gazans will become Egyptian citizens. And the ones, the Palestinians living in the West Bank, will become Jordanian citizens again. And the Israelis will maintain being Israeli citizens, and they will have joint control. And then you watch what happens in Syria. It's already in the works. And, you know, there's a game going on right now, because Syria knows that's what it's going to have to do, and Iran has a problem. You watch how Syria is going to end up with the lease agreement that's being talked about in Golan. And then there's another thing that people don't realize. The energy and the vibration is changing for a positive. And that's why there's so much hatred to antagonize. But if you go in Iran, you mark my words, there's going to be an implodement. You can go on the blogs and read and watch how Persians think. And that what country was one time one of the only democracies back in the 50s, of course. Thanks to our CIA, they had something to do with placing Shah back in there in the 50s. But that was the one time a democratic country. And it's going to implode. They don't want to be under Islamic fascism. the people there want freedom. They want their individual. They have a different mentality. And by the way, I was married to an Iranian woman, so I can tell you I know what's going on. I used to know what's going on there. I was new from all the Iranians, both Muslim and Jewish and Christian and Baath, who had lived there, even under Shah's time. But it's going to change, and they're going to implode and become a democratic country. The only problem is Iraq is going to become a Lebanon unless things are settled. It's going to be divided. That country was created, by the way, by the British, which now I'm getting off tangent here. That's the country where there's going to be a real problem with the Shiites and Sunnis and the Kurds. But that's what's where we're heading to. And I was going to get into thoughts are things. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to get into that definitely on my next show. Because actually that was going to be part of my next show. And I will get into that with thoughts are things and manifestations and so forth for my next show in 2 weeks. And just to let you know, I'm having a special guest coming on in next month, who is an astrologist. Her name is Carrie Dale, and she is going to bring astrology. That's what she told me she's going to do. She's doing the charts, natal charts and astrology charts of all the candidates running for president, or three of each, from Republicans and Democrats. But I had to get into this about the Middle East, because out of a situation that occurred through not only the politics of right now, but I had to clear off the chest of what's happening over there. Because people try to be politically correct, and there's a deep anti-Semitism, deep hatred toward Jews that's resurfaced its ugly face. I see it in the British, even with their supposed boycott toward Israel. You know what it is, it's purely anti-Semitic. Because if they're worried, why didn't they boycott? If they want to boycott Israel, then they should turn off their computers. Because every computer, by the way, has the Intel processors, Israeli technology, or Israeli parts. If you better get off your cell phones, because every single cell phone, Israeli parts, Israeli technology. Better not go to the doctor either and have some sort of surgery, because somewhere along the line, some of that medical equipment or technology or procedures has Israeli influence. And to an extremist, to the Muslims who hate Jews so much, they better, if they want to boycott the Yehud or the Jew or the Israeli that they don't like so much, they might all go back 200 years and walk away from all the technology and advances and stuff that's involved with that. You better not get your polio shot either, because that was a Jew who developed that. I mean, you can go on and on. I'm not saying if you want to be so anti-Semitic and so hatred toward Jews, you know, people need to learn enough of the hate. And any iman out there who is walking toward what is true Islam, which means part of peace. I'm not saying that there are scriptures in there which definitely called some very negative things about being very negative toward Jews and Christians. Just like there's some things that scriptures that Christians and Jews follow, but you don't hear. I mean, let me see. There are the Pat Robertsons who go out and say some really sickening things, but there are some, you know, true. And let me put it this way. God-loving, not God-fearing clerics out there, whether rabbis, priests, ministers, pastors, who come out and want to reach out to the other people of faith or difference of faith as a kindred and realize we all have to live on the same little planet, on this little teeny ship called Earth. And if people who truly believe in Allah, then they need to understand that the right arm cannot hate the left arm, because that they're part of the same body. And since Allah is everything and Allah is in everybody, if you hate the Jew or Christian or non-Muslim, then you hate Allah and you are not a real Muslim. You're not a true Muslim. A true Muslim will breathe in brotherhood love. I mean, Malcolm X found this out when he realized he had, in his original speech, very anti-Jew, very anti-white, until he went to Mecca and saw the thousands of different races and different peoples who circled around the famous rock, I forget what they call it, in, it's just my mind blank, around in Mecca and saw the different peoples. That was what was really great and unifying about, you know, in Islam, that they show a brotherly uniformity and they don't look at people past their ethnicity, past their love. Even when I used to go into the mosque, they used to welcome me as a Jew. Today, probably hell no, because that's not what's being spilled out now. And I won't call on an imam or any clergy of the Muslim faith and stand up. Because right now the persona of Islam is Islamic fascism, which is the Nazism of our era, who want to conquer and kill anybody who's not part of their system. Look at Hamas. We're going to ethnic, they call it ethnic cleansing any to the non-believers. Kill the Fatah because they're not Muslim enough. Kill the Jew because they're not even Muslim. Kill the Christian. Let's burn a church. What are the Hezbollah? People call them, oh, they're not so bad. No, they hate your guts. I've heard people here, I wasn't even on a Sean Owen Gintu, but said that I was being too not correct about Hezbollah. And I'm laughing because I know, even in their own chart, they hate, they teach hatred toward non-Muslims. They hate you. They want to kill you or subdue you. And people don't get it. That, and that one small percentage, because there's so many billions of Muslims, looks, gives a persona that there's a lot of them out there. But there's a lot of them remain quiet because out of fear, which is the old tactic the Nazis used in Nazi Germany. They use a fear thing, if we'll put a fatwa on you or kill you. Or, and this is, by the way, what used to happen in the West Bank. That's why in closed doors, they tell them they want to be Israeli. Outside, they want to be, because that's the culture in the Muslim culture, a thing of fear. But people need to have guts. They have to have be like Gandhi and stand up and take that chance. And say, you know what? I'm going to reach out and be have peace with Israel. Look what Anwar Sadat did. Okay, he got killed because he wanted peace with Israel. Yeah, Rabin wanted made peace with the Palestinians, and there was a crazy Jew who killed him too. Not saying that's much better, but you don't, it's not in the same, even close to the same amount that's out there. You don't see Jews or Christians getting on a ship and slamming it into a bunch of buildings and kill thousands of people, or on buses. And now you can go everywhere. Dalfour, what's that about? That's about Muslim right now, extremism, Islamic fascism. What about in Thailand, in Philippines, all the killings are going on because extremists of Islamic fascism, Nazism. That's our of our today. People want to open their eyes, but that's what the dark side, that's what the dark path people are leading toward, that dark area are heading to. And people have need to open their eyes, and that's our thing. There's, you know, when God created the earth, he created both in light and dark for choice. And there will be people who choose the dark side, and you have to realize that and face it and be a warrior of the light and stand up to it. And that's what I call into all the clerics. In particular now, for all the clerics and those who are even not clerics, who are Muslim, Islam, who follow the true faith of Islam. Because even as me as a Jew, we are both the son of Abraham. We are brothers. We're both the right hand and the left hand of the same body. There can be reached an agreement to always do a compromise of peace. There can always be a compromise without violence. It's stupid. It's prison planet mentality. We're not living in San Quentin prison deciding what jail, who owns what jail, or down in South Central with Bloods and Crips. That's stupid. To kill people over my God is better than God is absolutely stupid. I used to see that, and it was ridiculous. I used to see, watch in Lebanon. Rockets flying from Christian to Druze to Shiite to Sunni. Villages shooting at each other because they're of a different faith, a different ethnicity. That is absolutely retarded, I'm sorry to say. And anybody who wants to apologize for saying, oh, well, they're under this thing of toward terrorism or killing, they themselves are walking, I'm sorry, they themselves are walking toward the dark. That's not preaching, standing behind light and love and emphasizing love and peace. Put down your guns, put down your katushas. Then the walls come down. Then doors open up. Then there are no security fences and security this and security that. Then there are no airships that shoot down at inside villages trying to strike down militants who, after trying to hit them, kill innocent civilians. Because it all starts from the very cancer itself, the cancer of hatred. And when I see hatred, it burns me because I passionately see it, and I, to me, despise it. Why would somebody want to walk that path? I don't understand that. Because with every action, there's a reaction, and what they're going to receive is darkness. Gaza is an example. They chose the path of hatred, and what do they receive? That's why I do not feel sorry for their choices. It's like telling somebody, there's a door, you can go through the door and there's love and light on that side, or you can walk in the wall. And you still, they will walk and hit themselves in the wall. That is a sadness. And I'm telling you, there will be peace in the Middle East. I see it. I'm not calling myself a prophet or anything, because I never will. But there will be peace. Because our vibrational things are happening, they're changing this planet, which I'll get into next week. And by the way, I just want to thank Don and Wenda for having me on their show on last Saturday, which we got in a little bit of the creativeness of thoughts or things. And I want to get into that next show, and I promise you, even though I didn't get into it now, it's just when I deal with the Middle East thing, and partially because of the cancellation of my prior, the guest who I was going to have, happened to be over that situation, out of a disagreement with how I felt, I was trying to show, having lived there, and people have a persona of what things are there when they don't have a clue. And I had to really show it, because it pissed me off, let me put it frank. Because people do not know. Westerners who do not know, even Middle Easterners have no clue. Unless they live there. And even then, I've seen things, how they're fabricated. I'm just telling you. I remember seeing in Lebanon, back during the Lebanese War in the 80s, where the Israelis knocked out an anti-aircraft unit that the Palestinians and the Syrians had next to a hospital. And it blew off the side of a hospital because they bolted on the wall of the hospital. And the cameraman was showing, without the pieces of the aircraft, were showing the blown-out hospital, and he was reporting. By the way, I'm going to say he's from a European radio station. I don't want to say who because I might get attacked for it on the air. But I remember seeing him. I was pissed. I'm going, he's showing, oh, this hospital was attacked by the Israelis. Oh, you schmuck. What do you think that is? You see the damn gun, and you see the